Please turn your Bibles to Daniel chapter 1. Daniel and chapter 1. We'll read from verse 1 through to 16. In the third year of the reign of Jehoiakim, king of Judah, Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, came to Jerusalem and besieged it. And the Lord gave Jehoiakim, king of Judah, into his hand with some of the articles of the house of God, which he carried into the land of Shinar to the house of his God. And he brought the articles into the treasure house of his God. Then the king instructed Aspenaz, the master of his eunuchs, to bring some of the children of Israel, and some of the king's descendants, and some of the nobles, young men in whom there was no blemish, but good-looking, gifted in all wisdom, possessing knowledge and quick to understand, who had ability to serve in the king's palace, and whom they might teach the language and literature of the Chaldeans. And the king appointed for them a daily portion of the king's delicacies and of the wine which he drank, and 3 years of training for them, so that at the end of that time they might serve before the king. Now from among those of the sons of Judah were Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. To them, the chief of the eunuchs gave names. He gave Daniel the name Belshazzar, to Hananiah, Shadrach, to Mishael, Meshach, and to Azariah, Abednego. But David purposed in his heart that he would not defile himself with a portion of the king's delicacies, nor with the wine which he drank. Therefore he requested of the chief of the eunuchs that he might not defile himself. Now God had brought Daniel into the favor and goodwill of the chief of the eunuchs. And the chief of the eunuchs said to Daniel, "I fear my lord the king, who has appointed your food and drink. For why should he see your faces looking worse than the young men who are your own age? Then you would endanger my head before the king." So Daniel said to the steward, whom the chief of the eunuchs had set over Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, "Please test your servants for 10 days, and let them give us vegetables to eat and water to drink. Then let our appearance be examined before you, and the appearance of the young men who eat the portion of the king's delicacies, and as you see fit, so deal with your servants." So he consented with them in this matter and tested them 10 days. And at the end of 10 days, their features appeared better and fatter in flesh than all the young men who ate the portion of the king's delicacies. Thus the steward took away their portion of delicacies and the wine that they were to drink, and gave them vegetables. Well, we continue in our study of the book of Daniel. And over the last few weeks, I have introduced us to three things concerning this book. First, I introduced us to the book of Daniel in general, and we sought to appreciate something of the message of the book. And then I introduced us to Daniel and his three friends and the pressures that they were exposed to when they were taken into captivity in Babylon. We noted four pressures. First, the pressure of change. They experienced domestic change, cultural change, and even spiritual change. We looked at the pressure of indoctrination. We also looked at the pressure of persecution and the pressure of discouragement. These pressures were real and affected them in some way. We also noted in passing that Daniel and his friends stood against all the pressures that were arrayed against them. Last week, I introduced us to Daniel's God. And we see that in the book of Daniel, God is the God of heaven, the God of gods, the God of providence, the God of wisdom and might, the Lord, great and awesome, who keeps his covenant and mercy with those who love him and with those who keep his commandments. He is the God who is righteous, the Lord to whom mercy and forgiveness belongs, the God of salvation, who brought Israel out of Egypt, the sovereign God, the ruler of kingdoms and rulers, the protector of his people, to whom Daniel submitted and whom they obeyed above all men. This evening, we want to go back and consider in a little more detail Daniel and his friends stand in the midst of the pressures of a pagan world. We will also be looking at what their hopes were for the future. And there are three things I want us to reflect on as we think about that. First, the fact that Daniel resolved to become, Daniel resolved not to compromise or become a pagan Babylonian. He resolved not to compromise and become a pagan Babylonian. It was the expressed intention of Nebuchadnezzar to turn Daniel and his friends and all the Jews and every other foreigner that he had brought into his land into Babylonians. He wanted them to think Babylonian, to speak Babylonian, to love Babylon. He wanted them to become Babylonians. But Daniel had resolved that he would not become that. That is how he responded to these pressures, to the pressure of change that was calling him to become different than what he was when he first came into Babylon. And he purposed in his heart, we read here in verse 8. Daniel purposed in his heart that he would not defile himself with the portion of the king's delicacies, nor with the wine which he drank. He purposed in his heart to say no to the changes, to say no to all the pressures. And this is particularly highlighted in the matter of the new foods that they were expected to be eating. We read in verse 8 that he purposed in his heart that he would not defile himself with the portion of the king's delicacies or the wine. Now, there are two things this decision, this resolve, reveals about the character of Daniel. First, that he was a man of rare courage. He was a man of rare courage. He had the ability, in other words, to do something that was difficult, perhaps even dangerous. He was willing to defy the king's appointments. You will note in verse 5 that the king, not any other man, but the king, appointed for them a daily provision of the king's delicacies and of the wine which he drank. The king made that appointment. The king prescribed their diet. The king prescribed their training to prepare them to serve in the king's court. But Daniel determines to have nothing with it. There is a firm determination in Daniel's part not to do what the king had appointed. Now, that was an extremely courageous thing to do, because there was a possibility, wasn't there, that in deciding not to follow the king's command, that he would be arrested, perhaps even killed. And it was difficult to take such a stand. It was the king. How do you defy the king? How do you face the king? But it didn't matter to Daniel that it was the king. What mattered to him was what the King of Kings required. And because of that, he had the courage to withstand the lesser king. He was a man of rare courage. But secondly, notice that he was a man of admirable principle. He was a principled man. That is to say, he had very strong convictions to which he was committed. Now, why is it that Daniel took such a principled position? To think about that negatively, we have to say that he wasn't being merely stubborn. It was not because the food that the king had appointed, along with the drinks, were rich, perhaps unhealthy, and would therefore be harmful to Daniel and his three friends. It wasn't for that reason. The reason was that he recognized that the food and the drink of the king had been consecrated to idols. They had been dedicated to the religion of the Babylonians, if you will. And there comes a time when a man must make a stand. And make a stand, he did. In other words, he stood by the truth. That is what being principled involves. First, he stood by the truth about God. And we have already introduced Daniel's God, haven't we? The sovereign ruler of the sky, the creator of the universe, who has instituted and distributed his law to all men and to all creatures. The living God, the ruler of rulers, the God who would go on to protect Daniel and his friend, the true God. These idols to which the foods and the drink and the king himself had been committed were not true gods. These names that had been attached to Daniel's name and to his friends' names were not true gods. They were idols. They were false. They were to be rejected. He was going to stand on the truth about the God of his fathers, the God of Abraham and of Isaac and of Jacob. To reject that food was his way of rejecting those gods and standing by his God, the true God. But he also stood by the truth about the law of God. You see, it wasn't just that he'd been exposed to the true God, that his parents had raised him to understand something about that true God and to love that God and to choose that God. It was also that he knew the law that required him to have only one God, to worship only one God. There is no other God apart from this God who had brought them into Babylon. The law demanded that they worship only him, only that God. You see, when they moved into Babylon, they didn't leave their God behind. God didn't remain in Jerusalem. They may have destroyed his temple. They may have carried away the utensils of the temple. And that may have devastated the Jews. It may have depressed them to see the condition of the temple. But that did not mean their God had ceased to exist, and that the law had stopped demanding that they worship only him. Their God was still living. His law was still intact. If it was not to be seen anywhere in Babylon, it was deeply imprinted upon their hearts. And they stood on it. Daniel refused to compromise his convictions. He was a young man at this early stage in their time in Babylon. He was only a teenager, but he refused to eat the king's meat or to drink his wine. And he stood by that, not just at that moment in time. He continued to do so, even to his old age. In Daniel 5, verse 13 through to 17, for example, he refused the gifts of Belshazzar. He refused to bow to Belshazzar. Even under threat of persecution, he remained a principled man. We don't see many principled people in our day, in our age, in our time. Many, in the name of tolerance, do not have any convictions. And yet, you can't be tolerant unless you believe something firmly. You have to know something and believe something and be devoted to that deeply in order to tolerate others. If you don't believe anything, what you are saying is that nothing matters. You are not being simply tolerant there. You don't care to believe anything. That's what is happening there. You don't believe anything. You don't have any convictions. You don't care to believe anything. As long as things go well, maybe you are making a bit of money for yourself and you are comfortable, it doesn't matter. And you can be anything. You can be a Christian as well as a Muslim at the same time. You can be a Reformed Baptist as well as a charismatic at the same time. You just don't care what the distinctions are. You just don't care whether this is right and this is wrong. You just don't care. You can be heterosexual and homosexual at one and the same time. That's the world in which we are living, in the name of tolerance. It doesn't matter what you believe. It doesn't matter whether you believe anything or not. You live and let live. Tolerance. Daniel would have none of that, because it is wrong not to believe anything. We cannot but admire such a man. A man with convictions, deep convictions. And such men today are laughed at. They are maligned. In a postmodern world, you can't know the truth. You shouldn't know the truth. You are great to the extent that you sound vague about anything, because truth is an impossible thing to grasp or to know. So they are maligned. They are laughed at. They are seen to be bigoted and to belong to a bygone age. They don't quite fit in this postmodern age. Daniel was not ashamed to stand on the truth, to stand on convictions. Our country needs such men more than anything else. Men who believe in what is right, men who are determined to do what is right, men who are more concerned to do what is right than to win an election. Remember that when you vote. Men who are concerned about what is right, about honesty, about dignity, about righteousness, they are more concerned about that than winning an election. The church needs such men too. The church, by and large, these days is not respected, because the church is in the forefront of changing and turning. One day, we believe abortion is wrong, homosexuality is wrong. Then the world begins to make noise about it. And the church that is supposed to stand firmly on morality is sometimes the first to flip. And to confuse the world about whether there is such a thing as right or wrong. The church needs men who believe in what is right, men who are determined to do what is right, men and women of conviction. It is such men who have made a difference in the world, who have changed history, who have promoted good. This is how Martin Luther was. Long before him, this is how Augustine was, and John Calvin. The men who have made a difference in the faith are like that. Do we have such men in Zambia, in the church in Zambia? Do you count among such men who are willing to stand for the truth, who can speak with conviction, who can speak with feeling, who are willing to suffer for the truth, who are able to swear to their own hurt? We need such men. Do you count among them? Well, such was Daniel, a man of high principle. He could have exploited the luxurious life that was being offered him. He could have given himself to becoming totally identified with the Babylonians. There was a whole career ahead of him. He could have thought for him to have that career, for him to become that politician in Babylon and in Persia, he must compromise, he must become Babylonian. But Daniel determined, to use the language of verse 8, Daniel purposed in his heart that he would not defile himself with a portion of the king's delicacies. He will not defile himself with what the Babylonians were offering him. He determined in his own heart that he would not get involved than was necessary in the Babylonian lifestyle. That he would not abandon the faith in his God, the God of Israel. And particularly here, that he would not eat Babylonian meats that would have been offered to idols. Even as a young man, he realized that this seemingly harmless thing, eating of the king's delicacies, partaking of the king's meat and drinking of the king's wine, would have compromised his convictions, would have made it appear that it did not matter that you worship the true God, that it did not matter that you obeyed his law. Even at that young age, he realized this. And he stood. Someone has said, if we compromise when we should take a stand, the opportunity never comes back. There are people who say, let's compromise now. Another opportunity will come for us to stand. And the point is, it never comes. It never comes. We will not take that stand later. We will simply compromise more and more and more. We will become worse than we used to be. And so he did not compromise. He wanted to make the distinction clear between true religion and false religion. The religion of his fathers, the religion of Judah, was the true religion. The religion of Babylon was false. So the first way of standing firm in a pagan society is to become wide awake to the pressures around us and firmly resolved not to be pushed into that way of life, the way of life of the pagan society. That is the first thing I want us to know. Secondly, Daniel combined decisiveness with courtesy. He combined decisiveness with courtesy. Although Daniel was firmly resolved, we must make no mistake about that. Daniel purposed in his heart that he would not defile himself. He had a strong conviction. He stood on that conviction. But although he was firmly resolved not to adopt pagan ways, yet this did not mean that he would become aggressive and insulting and disrespectful of others, and particularly of the authorities that he was defying. He didn't do that. It would appear that he did everything that would keep away persecution from him. Take a look at this. Daniel purposed in his heart that he would not defile himself with the portion of the king's delicacies, nor with the wine which he drank. And then we read, therefore, he requested of the chief of the eunuchs that he might not defile himself. He requested. He behaved with great courtesy, trusting God to bring him through the difficult situation that he found himself in. He courteously requested. He courteously asked permission to live in a different way. He was a gentleman. And this is precisely where we fail, isn't it? You have resolved in your heart that you will not compromise. You have resolved in your heart that you will stand on what is right. And it is good, it is right for you to make such a resolution. But then we make the mistake of being arrogant about it, of being rude about it. And when we become arrogant about it and rude about it, we put people off. The Lord Jesus Christ says we are the light of the world. We are the salt. And that suggests that God has placed us in the world. It is His will that we live in this society, pagan though it might be, so we may be that light, so we may be that salt, and we need to carry ourselves in a way that will attract the world rather than put the world off. And when we are arrogant about our righteousness, we put the world off. If you are like me, you probably follow American politics, and you have a great divide there. You have the Republicans who are conservative, many of them are even evangelical on the one hand, and you have the Democrats who are liberal. There are some conservative ones there too. The Republicans are conservative, and they are sometimes evangelical. And when you hear them speak, sometimes they sound so arrogant. It seems to me that they put off the liberals, the world, the pagan world in which they are living. They could be attractive. They could woo the world to themselves. But they put them off because there is an arrogance. I'm not saying the liberals are not. But I'm saying those who are enlightened, who claim to follow God and to fear God, who claim to know the gospel, have a greater responsibility, don't they? It's the same for us. If we are more enlightened, and so we think, we pride ourselves in knowing the truth, in being reformed, in being Calvinistic, in holding to the great doctrines of grace that exalt the God of the Bible, that acknowledge the sovereignty of God. Doctrines that teach us that we did not save ourselves, we cannot keep ourselves. God, by his power, must find us and save us and sustain us and bring us to glory. It's none of our doing, none of our making. And yet we can so often come out proud and rude and arrogant. There was a time in this church when a great many were put off by Calvinistic young men, not because of the doctrines they held, but because of their attitude, because of the rudeness, the arrogance, being cheeky, thinking they were something and everyone was nothing. And so they didn't woo the people they were supposed to be wooing. They didn't make attractive these great and wonderful doctrines. And there is a chance, isn't there, that even today, there might be people who are being put off by Reformed theology and Calvinism. They may not even understand it. But they look at the attitude of the people who stand on these doctrines. People who have no courtesy, no respect. People who cry, grace, grace, but they don't show any grace in their character and life. Daniel did not count among those. He believed in the sovereignty of God. Oh, but look at him. Listen to him. He was determined to stand for God and yet willing to go to these pagans and with respect, with great courtesy, he sought their permission to live in a different way. He was a gentleman. Christians may live a distinctive life in a courteous manner. That's not a sign of weakness. To be respectful and kind and merciful and gracious is not a sign of weakness. It's a sign of strength. It's a sign that you can control yourself. You can master yourself. You can do the right thing without being offensive. That is strength. And what was the result of that? He won his way into the king's heart, into the eunuch's heart. He won his way into power. Listen. In verse 9, now God had brought Daniel into the favor and goodwill of the chief of the eunuchs. God was working on Daniel's behalf because Daniel was fully given to God and his ways. And God can always give us favor in the eyes of even those who are supposed to be our enemies. We may be surrounded by the most oppressive false religion, such as might have been found in the Babylonian court. And yet God can give us people who will sympathize with us, who will support what we do and what we stand for, who will be sympathetic with our cause. And this is what happened to Daniel. God brought Daniel into the favor and goodwill of the chief of the eunuchs. And the chief of the eunuchs said to Daniel, I fear my lord the king who has appointed your food and drink, for why should he see your face looking worse than the young men who are your age? Then you would endanger my head before the king. So Daniel said to the steward, whom the chief of the eunuchs had set over Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, please test your servants for 10 days and let them give us vegetables to eat and water to drink. And he tested them. He ignored the demands of the king to help Daniel, a captive, because of Daniel's attitude. Is that how it works for you? Are you a put off? When people hear you speak, they are put off. When people see you acting, they are put off. And you are supposed to be this God-fearing man or woman, but you are a put off. You don't attract anyone. You enrage the enemies of God. And they don't think well of you. And sometimes they persecute you, not because you are doing righteousness, but you are because you are undoing righteousness by your character and behavior. Let's hurry on to our third and final point. Daniel was expecting God to work on his behalf. He suggests a test to the Babylonian official. Verse 12, please test your servants for 10 days. Let them give us vegetables to eat and water to drink. Then let our appearance be examined before you and the appearance of the young men who eat the portion of the king's delicacies. And as you see fit, so deal with your servants. He suggested a test, and he believed and expected that God would help them to pass the test. Daniel was expecting God to work on his behalf and on the behalf of his friends. In the end, what happened? Look at verse 15. At the end of 10 days, their features appeared better and fatter in flesh than all the young men who ate the portion of the king's delicacies. Thus, the steward took away their portion of delicacies and the wine that they were to drink and gave them vegetables. As for these four young men, God gave them knowledge and skill in all literature and wisdom, and Daniel had understanding in all the visions and dreams. They were blessed. Now, this is a very important point for us to see. Look at the beginning of the chapter and how things turned out for the people of God. They'd been lifted out of Judah. The articles of the house of God had been carried into the land of Shinar. God appeared to be defeated. And there might have been people in Judah who thought that that great God who had freed their forefathers from slavery and brought them into the land of Canaan, a land flowing with milk and honey, had been defeated. He wasn't the powerful God he claimed to be. He wasn't the God of the universe he claimed to be. They would have thought so. They would have been in despair. Here they are now, in slavery, in captivity, and they didn't know for how long that would be. But look at what happens here. God was at work. In the action of Daniel, the grace of God triumphs. Indeed, God's grace begins to show itself here as being superior to the idols of Babylon. In this action of Daniel, he calls attention to the fact that the God of the Hebrews is not like the God of the other nations. The God of the Hebrews is different. The God of the Hebrews is unique. In a time of testing, he has proved, he has shown, and it may appear little, but he has proved and he has shown that he lives, that he is greater than the God who watched over Babylon. At the end of 10 days, their features appeared better and fatter in flesh than all the young men who ate the portion of the king's delicacies. God was vindicated here. That is the point. We must conclude. And we must begin with a question as we do so. Can we survive in an oppressive pagan kingdom? In an oppressive pagan world? Can we survive in a world such as we live? Well, the answer is yes. There is a false assumption that to get ahead in the world, to get ahead in this oppressive world, one must conform to the sinful practices of the world. One must conform. If the world is corrupt, you must also become corrupt. If the world is godless, you must also become godless. If the world is indifferent to what is right, you must also become indifferent. That is how you will survive. That is how you will push ahead. That is how you will be comfortable. You can't do it otherwise. Well, Daniel is saying, yes, you can. Yes, you can. And you can by resolving the following. Number one, you can by resolving not to become adjusted, not to accommodate yourself to pagan ways. By resolving, by standing on principle. Wishy-washy people can't do this. People who are not strong spiritually, they are not rooted in the Word. They don't care about the Word. They don't care about theology. Can't do this. And some of you could be in that category. You don't care to know. To know what is right. You don't care to know what the Bible teaches. You don't care to extract your theology from the Bible and to stand on it. People who don't do that can do this. Let us resolve to do this, not to adjust or accommodate ourselves to the world, but to remain devoted to the truth we know, to remain committed to the ways of God. Secondly, let us combine decisiveness with courtesy. Let us combine firmness with courtesy. That you are principled does not mean you must turn into a kind of beast who is screaming at everyone, who is shouting at everyone, who is not doing what is right. That doesn't attract the world. Decisiveness with courtesy. And thirdly, let us trust and expect God to work on our behalf. He has revealed himself. He has revealed his law. He has revealed his ways. And he commands us to know him, to love him, to follow his way. We must do it. We must commit ourselves to doing that and trust him to protect us. When we do it, trust him to stand with us when we do it. Is that what you are doing? Trusting God to work on your behalf. You love him, you follow him, you do what he expects. If there is any danger, you don't adjust. You do what God expects you to do. And you trust him to protect you. And God himself guarantees his favor. When we so do, we will gain his favor. The same way that Daniel was favored. You will be favored. You will be blessed. You will succeed. Not success after the manner that the world defines, but success in God's way. He will not leave you alone. He will be with you. He will bless your courage. He will bless your principledness. To live like that is to be like Christ. Look at what faced Christ. Look at the suffering that lay ahead of him. Look at how he was treated because of who he was, because of what he stood for, because of what he came to do, because of the righteousness he came to establish. Did he feel any fear in his heart because of the danger that stood before him? Yes. Did he wish, did he pray that God would somehow let the cup of suffering that faced him to pass so he doesn't have to go through that? Yes. But he was committed to doing the will of God. What he would suffer ultimately didn't matter. To do the will of God, that was his food. That was his drink. It must be yours too. Amen.